You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, everybody. I'm your host, Carrie Diamond, and you're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb. Each week, we talk to the most interesting women in the world of food and bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life. Special thanks to our sponsor, Emmy, the maker of delicious traditional cheeses from Switzerland. If you love beautiful Swiss cheeses, look for Emmy's premier Kaltbach label and cheeses such as Emmentaler, Gruyere, and Le Cremeux, aged in the 22-million-year-old Kaltbach cave for superior flavor unlike anywhere else in the world. If you are daydreaming about culinary school, maybe it's time to say bonjour to Le Cordon Bleu. You can learn more about the legendary culinary school's most prestigious professional qualification, Le Grand Diplôme, by visiting cordonbleu.edu. So obviously, it's been a crazy week at Cherry Bomb HQ. If you follow anything that we do with the brand, you know that our Jubilee Conference is on Saturday. It is sold out, which is very exciting. I'm sorry to all those people who've been emailing me who want tickets. We literally don't have any more tickets left. But it's been really fun planning this one. We have an incredible lineup. The food and beverage lineup just went live this morning, and you have to look at it. It's such an amazing list of people. We start off with this great beauty breakfast with Whole Foods. We have this incredible lunch. Dig In has all their female chefs doing the lunch. One of my favorite parts of the day, collabs and cocktails, is when we get everybody together to do these incredible collaborations. And I kind of am still pinching myself at all the people we have working on it. We're doing stuff with our friends from Emmy, who've been such gracious sponsors of the show, and on and on and on. You have to check out the cherrybomb.com and go look at the schedule, look at the participants, look at the food lineup. It's really great. And if you aren't coming, you can just follow all the action on Instagram. The hashtag is CB Jubilee. This year we have a really fun thing. We've got two artists coming who are doing live drawings throughout, and they draw on their Instagram, on their notebooks, on everything. We've got Jessie Wiener, who you've heard before on Radio Cherry Bomb. You can follow her at The Franco Fly. And then my old friend, Tish Cook, is an incredible illustrator. When we worked together, we worked in fashion. We were at Women's Wear Daily. And Tish now works for Tiffany, and she is a brilliant illustrator, and you can follow her at Tish Cook. So we're going to jump right into the show because we have two amazing people with us in the studio today. Our first guest is Elizabeth Faulkner. She attended art school, made a name for herself at Citizen Cake, a dessert-forward cafe in San Francisco, and went on to open additional restaurants, become a regular face and force on the Food Network, and serve as president of the organization Women Chefs and Restaurateurs. Most importantly, she has a ton of friends in this industry, and they all seem to adore her, and I want to find out what her magic is all about. Elizabeth Faulkner, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm really excited because we know each other socially, but I don't really know you, so it was fun to read up on you a bit and have this time to get to know you better. And in reading up on you, I found this old article in Gourmet magazine, rest in peace, Gourmet, in which they called you a high-wire artist. And I thought that was so interesting because it seems to still very much apply to you because you don't seem to be afraid of anything. You take on lots of challenges. You do so many interesting things. Is it fair to say that still applies to you?
That might be a good term. I haven't actually come across that article in a long time. But I've always really loved the artistic side of cooking. So when I found culinary right after college, basically in San Francisco, I went to San Francisco Art Institute, but I was working at Williams-Sonoma part-time back then, and this is like the late 80s.
In a store? Or in
the original store.
Wow.
Yeah. And this is, that store doesn't even exist anymore. It was on Sutter Street. That was the original one. So I was kind of, you know, I had grown up in Los Angeles and there were movie stars around, whatever, in LA, Malibu area. And then when I moved to San Francisco, the celebrities were chefs and they were coming into the store all the time. And I picked up their cookbooks and I was already kind of really into cooking and baking at home, but I never thought about it as a career. So
who were the big shots on the scene back then?
Well, I mean, like Julia Child would come into the store and Jacques Pepin, and anytime anybody was in town, like a lot of food stylists would come in all the time. And I just started picking up their books and reading more. And then I went to Chez Panisse and I went to Zuni, and Cindy Paulson was such a great chef. And Barbara Trop had China Moon up the street. And so I just started falling in love with all this food stuff going on because it was like an art revolution to me.
Why did you go to art school?
I went to art school because my dad is an abstract painter. And so I grew up going to museums and theater and all that kind of stuff all the time. And it just, I think it's in our DNA. I have another brother who's a rock star and another brother who's a filmmaker and eclectic dancer and storyboard artist. So it's just in our blood.
Okay, so I have to follow up with your brother's really a rock star?
For real.
For real?
And my brother Jason, he's a solo artist. His name's Jason Faulkner. Uh-huh. And he also currently is playing guitar with Beck on tour. But he has solo records and has played with a lot of bands that you've heard of. Air.
Very cool.
Jellyfish way back when and a bunch of stuff.
Well,
he's been
fun.
Playing since he's like a little genius. He's not little, but you know, he was a little genius.
I have a brother in real estate and a brother who is in financial planning, but who does surf uh-huh. on the side. No rock stars in the family. So you're going to art school. You're in San Francisco, intrigued by the culinary world. What made you decide to follow that path instead of following the art path?
Well, I mean, so in art school, I was studying mostly film. And you have to remember, this is before video and the way we look at videotaping stuff today. So I was actually using film, and it's very expensive. And then I started using it in more, I mean, I went to a fine art school, so I wasn't interested in making like Hollywood movies or something, but I started making installation pieces where I would use film as part of the visual effect. So it's funny because I still kind of, after building restaurants and, you know, I got into it because I really like to cook, and my friends would always say, you know, you're so good, you should be cooking. And then, but I didn't go to culinary school. And then I kind of just landed this job in a little French bistro where we made a lot of croque monsieur every day using a lot of Gruyere cheese. And
I should take this opportunity to say, you brought me the best grilled cheese sandwich.
Well, it's grilled cheese sandwich day.
I did not know it was grilled cheese sandwich day. And it's so funny because we have a friend from Emmy here, and we have a whole cheese display in the studio, which is hilarious, and we'll talk about it later. But yes, you're the first one to bring me food connected to a national food holiday, so I have to thank you for that.
Well, so I do, I mean, I do make up some recipes for Emmy, and it's not a hard job because I really love the cheeses, and I've been to Switzerland and kind of met some of these cheesemakers. And anyway, because it's National Grilled Cheese Day, I thought this is a kind of a grilled cheese version of my cauliflower croque monsieur that I made up recently. So.
Yeah, this is no, like, if I were to say I made a grilled cheese sandwich, it would resemble nothing like your grilled cheese sandwich. So walk us through, because this is a work of art.
Well,
since we're talking about art school, this is a work of art of grilled cheese.
Well, thank you. I mean, like, at this little bistro that I used to work at, you know, we would make the classic croque monsieur and the croque Savoyard with
tomato.
Oh, tell
everybody what a classic croque monsieur is in case they don't know.
Sure. And it's
in case they've had sad lives and they haven't had any croque monsieur.
It's kind of like when you go to Paris, you have to go to some cafe and have a croque monsieur while you're there. There's a croque monsieur, a croque madame, and a croque Savoyard. And that's kind of what I made a lot of way back when. And so usually it's pain de mie, which is like your Pullman loaf of white bread. Some people do it on brioche and other breads. I personally like a Levant kind of sourdough bread, and that's probably from San Francisco. But then you put Gruyere cheese on it and ham, and then you put some cheese on top of it and stick it under the broiler, so you get this sort of double grilled cheese situation. And a Savoyard has tomato in it. A croque madame has an egg.
Oh, Croque Madame is my favorite. I don't think I've ever even seen it. Savoyard. Like Savoy.
Savoyard, yeah.
Oh.
I probably
okay.
don't pronounce it correctly.
Oh, I don't know. But I don't think I've ever even seen that on a menu in France or here.
It may have been trendy but way back when. Okay. I don't know. But
so it's basically a croque monsieur with a slice of tomato.
Mm-hmm.
Love it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so eventually at my restaurant in San Francisco, I had. We used to make all of our own bread. We made everything. And at one point when truffle salt kind of hit the market, I made up a croque truffe, which was sautéed mushrooms in season, and then a little bit of truffle salt on it, and then put that between some of our homemade sourdough bread with Gruyere. And we made this like Gruyere creamy mixture with, it had a little fromage blanc and Gruyere and egg and nutmeg in it. So we just smushed that on there and then put some on top, salamander. It was ridiculous. And it was one of those really aromatic kind of sandwiches that everybody's like, I have to have that now. And so thinking about one today, I was like, I love how everybody's getting more and more obsessed with vegetables. And I love that cauliflower is like on a lot of menus. It's just it's creatively being exploited, which is fun. You know, we do that with vegetables time and time again. So
cauliflower and Brussels sprouts totally rescued from the... From the depths, everybody used to hate them, and now people can't get enough.
Broccoli, all that stuff. And they are so good for you. That's the thing. It's not like just about being a chef and making flavors. It's about what's the nutrients in there. So I love, and everybody can eat this sandwich because it's vegetarian. And so I have, in this one, I have a little bit of apricot orange marmalade that I kind of turned into a chutney just by adding fresh turmeric and fresh ginger and a little bit of vinegar.
Oh, that's why I've recovered. My voice slightly, because there's turmeric, ginger, and vinegar in there. Okay. That's the tanginess, I guess.
Yeah, and then I roast the cauliflower with a little bit of curry powder.
Okay.
And kind of stick that in lots of cheese. So this one has some of the Le Cremant, and it also has Kaltbach aged Gruyere and a little bit of Scharfamax.
Yeah.
Another Appenzeller style cheese.
So the sandwich is still warm. Did you make it, like, run out the door?
Yeah.
Where do you live?
I live in Brooklyn Heights. So I just...
Okay.
I Ubered over here. I like finished the sandwich, put it in the bag, and called the Uber.
I'm impressed. Thank you very much. It was really nice of you to bring it by. Okay, so you sort of veer off from art school, fall in love with culinary world. You're in San Francisco at a really cool time.
Yeah, great
time. To be
in
San Francisco. I've talked about this before, that if we had been in San Francisco, we might have never launched Cherry Bomb because there was such a great women in food community there.
That's 100% true. I did write this piece recently about bad behavior getting in the way of great work, and
you wrote that for Food and Wine.
I did on their blog, I talked about this where in California in the late 80s, early 90s, there were so many strong women run kitchens. So it's been different on this coast. It's different in different parts of the world. But California, we were lucky because I already had these role models of Joyce Goldstein with Square One Restaurant and Barbara Trop, Cindy Paulson, obviously Alice Waters and Judy Rogers. But then also Mary Sue and Susan down in Los Angeles. And they had a restaurant called City that I went to in my early days. And Nancy Silverton. I mean, just a lot of Nancy Oaks, just a lot of people. That were already running these very professional, great food making, revolutionary kind of restaurants. You know,
but
bringing in agriculture and
why was California and San Francisco in particular so singular in just being such a great place for women? Like that was not the case in New York or Chicago or other cities.
You know, did you read Joyce Goldstein's The California Food Revolution?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think she that's a really good book. I mean, she really talks about how the food evolved in California and how a lot of chefs and purveyors were making, I mean, like that she knows the people that I know, the people that made up the spring mix that we see like on everybody's menu in every grocery store. There were people that were just like, oh, we have all these lettuces, let's put them in a bag together and sell it. And it's springtime, we'll call it spring mix. And I just feel like California has been this place where things just change. It's been that kind of environment there for a long time, you know?
Yeah. Joyce spoke at our Jubilee in San Francisco and she was great. She talked about how it was just from her perspective, it was just this very counterculture spirit that took hold there. And, she talked about how the French brigade system came over to America. A lot of what was going on in New York and Chicago was modeled on that, and it just never took hold in San Francisco. And you had men, women, everybody working in kitchens together, looking at each other as equals.
I mean, even the French trained or French chefs that came to California in those days, they were already kind of in their own rebellious way. Even Wolfgang Puck is somebody who was changing. He didn't want to stick to the old European ways, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, he was already, the food was, it's so inspirational to be in California because of the agriculture alone. Because you just go to the market and you're like, oh my gosh, there's like 20 kinds of tangerines here.
You know? So why in the world did you come to New York?
I came to New York for several reasons. I closed my restaurants in San Francisco. It was kind of a rough time around after 2008. So I moved here in 2012. And I'd always wanted to live in the East Coast, and in New York in particular. And I had come out of a relationship and just kind of like, okay, I kind of need like a start over button. And I also knew that it was going to be challenging for me cooking-wise to be in the East Coast. I wouldn't have all those fruits and vegetables like I'm so used to in California. And I would have to pickle more things and really adapt to the true seasons. But I like challenges, so I was like, yeah, I can do this. And I didn't mean
it
in
goes back to the high wire thing.
I don't mean that in a very cocky sort of way. I really just embrace the idea of wherever I'm living and the kind of culture that's around it, I'm interested in learning things from. And that will help me be even a better chef.
You're probably sitting there saying, what the hell is she doing? She's interviewing me and typing on her computer at the same time. I'm trying to be like real multimedia here. I just tweeted out your article in Food and Wine. So if anybody wants to read the article that Elizabeth just mentioned, it's on our Twitter feed right now. And I just found the Joyce Goldstein book and I'm tweeting that out too.
Oh, great. Yeah.
So if you want to buy it, Joyce is amazing. I kind of look at Joyce as like we have Mimi Sheraton here in New mm-hmm. York and San Francisco has Joyce Goldstein.
That's right.
They're both kind of like truth tellers and legends and
full of stories.
Oh my God, full of stories. So if you want to get Joyce's book, it's I think I just tweeted it.
It's so funny. I had a obsession when I had my restaurant Orson. We had a wood burning oven, and I had this obsession of making bialys for a while after reading Mimi's book, The Bialy Stalkers. And I read two books about bialys, and I was like, wait a minute, I already make all these breads. I need to embrace the bialy. And nobody was making those in San Francisco.
Yeah, tell everybody what a bialy is, too. I don't think everyone knows that.
Bialy is another bread that comes from Poland, from Bialystok, Poland. And it was more popular than the bagel before the wars. And they just kind of, that whole town got wiped out in World War II. And so then, unfortunately, they kind of just, they didn't catch on as much in New York as a lot of the population here was making bagels already. But they are not boiled, they're baked, and they have just a little bit of onion and poppy seed on them. And they're just like a little mini, almost like simple pizza, really. And I love pizza, so I just was kind of crazy about going back and making it like they might have made it in Poland. And I called Nancy Silverton, and I was like, you know, have you ever made them? And I'm obsessed with what kind of salt they might have used and what kind of flour. And I talked to Mimi, and then I came to Joyce and brought her some samples, and she tasted them, closed her eyes, and she's like, they don't taste exactly like the ones from Brooklyn that she had grown up with. And so it was just so much fun
Wait,
to have.
Joyce grew up in Brooklyn too?
She's from
Oh, how funny.
From New York.
Yeah. So Mimi's from Brooklyn.
Yeah.
But hates Brooklyn. If you're listening, Mimi, I feel like I can speak for you because you've gone on the record about your feelings for Brooklyn. But she's come to the radio show a few times. Okay, so bialys. You're obsessed with bialys. What happens next?
I started making them for a while and had some following. That's kind of what I did in my, mm-hmm. on my baking side. I would just kind of become obsessed with something for a while and then we'd sell that and work on that. And if it stuck, we would keep it on the menu. Otherwise we'd keep moving.
So were you happy that you came to New York?
Oh yeah. I'm really happy. San Francisco is obviously a great place to live. I lived there for 25 years. I, you know, started cooking there. I owned restaurants for a while and then, came here, opened a pizzeria, then opened a restaurant on the Upper West Side. And then I stopped and said, okay, I need a timeout from all that. And luckily...
Why? What was going on?
Managing restaurants for 26 years is pretty intense.
Yeah.
It's like all consuming. I never had any time for my family. I missed a lot of holidays. I didn't really... It was just hard to have relationships, period. because I was just obsessed with getting everything done at work all the time, is it just is a consuming kind of business. I have a friend who said, you need a little time out. And it took me about a year to get used to, I had some kind of post-traumatic restaurant stress disorder because I was so used to people, you know, texting me and saying, oh, I'm going to be late, I'm on the train, this vendor is, you know, the fish came in wrong, whatever. And I'm just used to that sort of traffic control. And so I stopped and started writing a book. So hopefully that's going to come out soon. I'm kind of waiting, trying to be patient from my agent about what's happening with it. But I've edited it with an editor at Inkwell Management. So I'm pretty excited about it.
That's a big deal. So you took it. So the year you took off, you worked on a book.
I started it, and it took me, it's taken like 4 years. Mm-hmm. It's quite a process. You know, the first draft of it, well, the first year of it was just me having therapy basically with myself. And then I started honing in on it. And then I still cook all the time. I get invited to a lot of the food and wine festivals. I do a lot of charity events still. I love to cook for people. So it's not like, I don't like this whole idea that a chef is only identified with a restaurant. I think, yeah, I've paid my restaurant dues, but I still love doing all these events, and that's why I do it. I'm not even trying to sell a restaurant at the events. I might be selling some Gruyere cheese, but sometimes I'm working for different brands or doing recipe development.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because I think you're such a good role model for people in this industry who really don't see beyond restaurants. You know, and it is crushing and brutal and hard work.
And it's great work. I'm not knocking it. I love it.
You know, if you've done it for several decades, you have kids or whatever, you know, it's challenging. But I think it might be scary thinking, like, what else is out there? What's beyond there? But you've shown you do so many things. You know, you work with lots of brands. Like, how does that even work? I mean, you're here. One of the reasons you're here is because you work with Emmy.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted you to talk about that. But how does a chef even start working with brands?
Well, I mean, even when I was running my restaurants, I was working with a company in San Francisco called Center for Culinary Development. And so they will have big brands come to them and, you know, need some chefs to basically consult on flavor extension lines, new products. So I've always kind of liked, you know, real restaurant, home cooking food, all that kind of stuff. But I'm sort of fascinated by industrial food and how things get manufactured and what that, you know, the sacrifices you have to make for the kind of recipe it is. And I took on a lot of those little jobs. And then I also, in the early 2000s, got hired by Molina Bianco, which is a sister company to Barilla Pasta. And I worked for... It was really a cool project because it was an R&D thing on really wanting to... Starbucks was the end client. So they, at the time, Italy wanted to... They were like... One of the VPs loved that they were revolutionizing coffee in America, but they felt like the food offerings needed help. So they said, we can do all the bakery stuff. We're going to hire a team to do all this research of what people are eating across the country and then come up with a new line. So I was the chef on that.
You got to work on that. That sounds like fun.
And that was so cool. I worked with sensory analysis people. And,
wow.
Just fascinating. Food scientists learned about enzyme technology. And, you know, this is right around the time that the molecular sort of movement started. And so I was just kind of like learning about all different kinds of hydrocolloids. And
what's a hydrocolloid?
Hydrocolloids are gelling and setting agents. So anything from agar to gelatin to different starches. So kuzu or, cornstarch. It's funny when people say they're not into that stuff. I'm like, well, you probably use cornstarch and gelatin in your cooking. So but you are, actually.
Whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
So do you need an agent when you do those things?
Well, I didn't. I mean, I was actually blind interviewed for that. Mm-hmm. And then they called me and said, you know, we want to hire you for this team. And that was a 2-year project. And I was running Citizen Cake and kind of going back and forth to Parma, which, you know, wasn't a bad job.
Wait, you get to go to all these great places. So Emmy's taken you to Switzerland, and you got to, what did you do when you went to Switzerland with Emmy?
Oh my gosh, well that was just last year, and it was great because we met all these, we went to these little farm cheesemaker, like just so boutique cheesemaker kind of people, and You know, it was brutal. We had to have fondue for lunch one day, and then the next day we had raclette with potatoes and lots of cornichons and all that stuff that gets served with that melty, delicious cheese. We went to the Kaltbach Caves and saw all these cheeses aging in the most beautiful environment. And I think we woke up and had cheese every day. Yeah. It was sort of like
more
a cheese-a-thon. Luckily, I ran in the Swiss Alps.
Did you?
Well, yeah,
that must have been
there.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
So I know you're a fondue snob because we had fondue together this winter at that hotel that was doing it in the yurts.
Yeah.
There
it
was really fun. There was actually a place in Manhattan, the Standard Hotel in the mm-hmm. East Village, that set up yurts in its side yard and was serving fondue. And I was like, this might be the best thing I ever heard of. So we all had fondue that night.
They did a great job, too, because they served lots of different little things with it.
Yes.
That's what
really
I
want to
see with fondue.
Way more about fondue than I could ever hope to know.
Well, you know what's really cool is what I learned in Switzerland, too, is that they, for some reason, they serve pineapple with next to the fondue. I mean, sort of like something that you're going to eat. And huh. I was asking people as we went around the country, what's up with the pineapple? Like, when did that happen? Like, was it just some campaign from Dole that came here? What happened? You know, how did it happen? And nobody could answer the question.
That's crazy. Is it their version of like Hawaiian pizza?
No, it's not even like that. It's sort of just another.
Actually, if I could jump in.
Oh, yeah. Allison's jumping in.
I have to talk. I'm so excited about this. So pineapple, it's just the perfect cut through that rich, thick,
fatty.
And especially they do it canned, like a lot of canned pineapple too, which boggled my mind too. And every time I serve fondue at home, you know, my family and my husband are like, why are we having this jarred canned pineapple here? But it's so perfect. That and like peaches too, like canned peaches.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really good.
I was going to ask Chef Faulkner about the taste profiles there, the cheese and the pineapple. Like, why are they, because, you know, you see all these different things. You've got Hawaiian pizza, even though some people think that's the worst invention known to man. And now you're telling us they have pineapple with fondue.
Well, I like a Hawaiian pizza.
You do? Well, you're from California.
Well, I may be more of a pizza snob than a fondue snob because I think
really?
Nancy Silverton does a really good pineapple speck and jalapeno pizza.
I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Okay. Anyway, but I like the pineapple with Gruyere because to me the flavors are there is almost like pineapple notes in the cheese. So it's interesting because the acid surely does cut some of the creaminess going on. But I also think that it's, when I put them together, in fact, I made a Swiss cheese steak kebab recipe for Emmy recently, and that is a really good combination because it's kind of a throwback. That for me, that idea of pineapple and especially like green bell peppers. Green bell peppers, I don't even know, it's not a trendy ingredient right now, you know? Like everybody wants to use the red,
no,
not the green.
Poor green peppers.
But they're really good. And peppers are really, you know, they have a lot of vitamin C. They're quite good for you. They have just all kinds of stuff in it. But I wanted to put like the idea of a shish kebab, the cheese, like a creamy Gruyere fondue sauce, steak, and jalapeno and green pepper and pineapple together on a skewer. And so it's like this kind of like shish kebab meets a Philly cheesesteak with some, you know, I might put it with some bread cubes, or I served it recently at Pebble Beach Food and Wine with little toasted panko crumbs on top of it. Like a little teeny one. It was the cutest thing I've ever seen. And but that little bit of pineapple with the cheese sauce is really good.
It like wakes it up. It's
yeah.
just like a little, there it is. It's good.
Yum. Oh my gosh. So what, you said you ran through the Swiss Alps. You are a runner, right? You do.
I did. I ran the New York Marathon in 2016.
Good for you.
That's the only full one I've done. I did it for myself for my 50th birthday. And then I'm running the Shape New York women's half this Sunday, actually. So right. Half marathons are not as tragic to your body. I can handle it. Still a lot. It's a lot of training.
I've never run a marathon or a half marathon or a quarter marathon, so bravo.
It's fun, though. I think there's something cool about, especially I've run the Brooklyn half, the New York half, mm-hmm. Staten Island half I ran last October. It's just kind of fun to see New York that way.
Very
I did
cool.
one at the zoo once, the Bronx Zoo. That was the
you
only
did.
Yeah.
You did? Good for you.
I mean, and got through it.
The famous Bronxer Marathon.
Yeah, yeah, yes. Whatever it was.
All right, you're probably wondering who this third person is with us. So we are going to take a quick break and hear a word from our sponsors. And when we come back, you're going to meet Allison Lacey. I'll be right back.
It's time for a quick cheese lesson from our friends at Emmy, the makers of traditional, authentic, delicious cheeses from Switzerland. Le Cremeux is a new, luxurious cheese from the Kalt Bock Cave. Sweet and unassuming at first, this semi-firm cheese keeps you coming back as its flavors and texture develop. Emmy's Kalt Bock Le Cremeux is aged in their 22-million-year-old natural sandstone cave. Whether you are snacking or party planning, serve your Kalt Bock Le Cremeux with blackberries, pineapple, or honey, and pair it with iced green tea or a bright Chardonnay, Chenin Blanc, or Riesling. Look for the red and blue Emmy logo at your favorite local grocer.
Are you daydreaming about culinary school again? Make this the year your dreams become reality with Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Study classic French culinary techniques in cuisine and pâtisserie as part of their exclusive 9-month Le Grand Diplôme and graduate into a world of opportunity. You also can extend your course of studies to include culinary management and dedicated internships. Le Cordon Bleu has locations in more than 20 countries around the world and located within some of the best food cities out there. London, Ottawa, Madrid, Bangkok, Tokyo, and of course, the spiritual home of cuisine and Le Cordon Bleu, Paris. Turning your daydreams into reality is closer than ever. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more and let your culinary adventure begin. All right, we are back with Chef Elizabeth Faulkner and our friend Allison Lacey from Emmy. And Allison has spent the past 5 years becoming intimate with cheese. With a background in marketing, she took a 2-year detour to get a culinary degree, work in a restaurant, food media, and has come full circle as the marketing brand manager for Emmy Cheeses from Switzerland. When she's not eating cheese, she's sipping on the Negronis and hanging out with her dog, Rue. And Rue loves cheese, and Rue even has a hashtag.
She does.
Yes, Rue loves stinky cheese.
Yep.
Yes, Rue needs more pictures, though, on that hashtag.
We got to work on that, yeah. She, anytime I open cheese, like, for sampling, whatever, it's like no matter where she is in the house, it's like, boom, like, there she's right there waiting for the cheese. Yeah.
What kind of dog is Rue?
She's a mix. She, we adopted her when we were living in Wisconsin, and she's like a shepherd, hound, foxhound. She's definitely hound. She loves to sniff and smell, and but she's great. She's a good girl.
Oh, Rue is such a good dog name, isn't it?
Yeah, she's actually a blonde color, too, so it was like perfect because my husband and I are both into food, and so she's a blonde Rue, like the French Rue, yeah.
Well, I'm so excited both of you are here because, you know, Elizabeth, like I said earlier, you're such a good role model for women in this industry who are just like, they don't see one path for them. And you've taken so many paths and done so many things and done them well and been so courageous. And Allison, along the same lines, you know, for people who love food, but they're like, I'm not a chef. I can't cook like Elizabeth Faulkner. You know, you've had an interesting path through as well. How did you break into the food world?
So I, like you said, I started my career in marketing. I got my degree at Marist College, and then I came to New York, and I worked in traditional agencies for a couple years. It was like right when Mad Men had started, so I'm like, yes, that's what I want to do, all that jazzy stuff. But then after a while, I was just getting bored with it. I was working on these accounts that I was just not really passionate about, and I just felt like to myself, if I'm going to sell something, if I'm going to work this hard on something, I really need to believe in it, and I really want to feel like, you know, I can add value to whatever this is. So again, around the time of 2008, when the economy was having some hiccups, I was laid off and I kind of decided to go to culinary school just because I wanted to work on a food brand. And back then, you know, I was younger. I was like, I want to work on Oreo or something like fun, like CPG, like really that, like those guys look so like so much fun. So I went to culinary school for a year, and then I tried restaurants. I worked at John DeLucci's restaurant, The Lion, for a couple months. I had some internships at Food & Wine and some other online stuff, and it was just really hard then to get a job at these, like, media places, these magazines. Like, you know, I'd beg Crate Cater, like, you know, like, hey, you know, we did this cocktail book together. Like, is there anything, you know, and like without being, you know, crazy about it. But it was just hard to get into. So then I had some odd jobs. I worked at Williams-Sonoma, like Elizabeth.
Oh, all these Williams-Sonoma connections. No,
and the one in Columbus Circle.
The big one.
Yeah, the flagship one. I worked at some other, like, I had other random jobs. I worked at City Winery, all this stuff. And then at one point, my husband was working in Midtown at Rosemary's, and I'd walk from City Winery to meet him. And I'd pass Murray's Cheese Shop, and I would just sit outside the bench and wait for him there, and I would just be like, oh, it looks so cool. Like, they're just having so much fun in there. Like, cheese is just, like, a happy place to be.
Wait, I have to write that down. Cheese is a happy place to be.
It is. You know,
it's
going
to be your next T-shirt.
You talk to people, and cheese is just that we're happy people. You know, we're just, you know, we just love what we do, and there's a lot behind it. So anyway, so it was like I was like scouring LinkedIn for jobs, and I found this job for Emmy, and the office was way up like the Palisades. So it wasn't like one of those jobs that there were like already like 600 people had applied to, because it was like not in the middle of New York City. So I applied, and I went up for the interview, and that's all there was to it. Yeah, it was funny. That summer I had actually went with my friend to Pennsylvania. She lives not too far from like dairy farms and stuff. So I was like, had all these pictures with cows. I showed the, you know, the woman in HR. I'm like, look, I love cows. Like, I'm perfect for the job. So it's been 5 years now, and I've loved all of it. I've learned a lot, and it's been great working on a brand. And I really do feel that going to culinary school really helped me just understand cheese more and understand working with people like Elizabeth. And, you know, we do have a food service channel that we work with at Emmy. And I just feel like it was like all those like crazy weird experiences I had like really just set me up for life, even though it was like a detour. It all came together.
You two could have like a jobs counseling business on the side. I know you need another side hustle, Elizabeth.
I think what's so cool, though, about we started talking about going to Switzerland and learning about the cheeses and stuff, but really, I was so inspired by that. I did this installation last year at Star Chefs, but the thing that really gets you when you're there, and what Americans don't understand that differentiates different kinds of Swiss cheeses, I think Americans think Swiss cheese, okay, it's the one with the holes in it. That there's so many different cheeses in Switzerland, so to just say Swiss cheese, that's a giant category of cheese.
Yeah. Cheese is a category, like Italian cheese or Spanish cheese. I mean,
So many different styles, and there's so much tradition in it. But the thing that's so captivating about Switzerland is the Alps, obviously, but the grassy mountains and valleys where all of that alpine water is draining down to the lakes and rivers. And so there you have cattle, these Swiss brown cows, and they're beautiful cows, dairy cows, grazing on all of that like high altitude alpine herbs and grasses. And that actually does add to the enzymes in their milk, which differentiates that cheese from other cheeses, even if they're made the same way.
Yeah, and the animal welfare practices in Switzerland are like the best in the world. And other things too, like we were trying to get them to put like things like non-GMO or organic on our packaging, and they're like, "What do you mean? What is GMO? That's prohibited in Switzerland. They know nothing about it because everything is just so naturally done that to them it's like a foreign concept that we need to explain to people. You know that there aren't any things happening here.
So you're going to give us a little cheese lesson because you've got three cheeses right next to you, and a beautiful cheese knife there.
Yes.
And so what have you cut up for us?
So the Kalpak cheeses are the premier part of our brand. They've been aged in this 22 million year old natural sandstone cave. And what happens with these cheeses, we've launched two that have pretty, you know, good recognition right now, the Gruyere and the Emmentaler. And what happens is, so there's maybe, you know, 100 and something Gruyere cheesemakers in Switzerland, and then Emmy works with a smaller group of them. And then even culled down further are, you know, 18 or so cheesemakers that make the really, really, really great Gruyere, and that can continue aging on into these caves. So a typical Gruyere can be like, you know, 6-7 months, and then it's released for sale. But what we do is we really pick the best that have the potential to age. And they go into this cave, and they finish there. It's like 12 months by the
time. And it's a real cave.
It's a real cave.
22 million years old. That blows yeah. my mind every time I hear that.
Yeah, that's the thing, too. Like, in the U.S., people say cave age, but it's like a man-made cellar, or it's something that's temperature-controlled by humans, you know. But this is, I mean, it's a natural cave, and there's natural... There's a river that runs through it. Actually, Kaltbach means cold brook in, I think, German or something. Mm-hmm. So this brook, this water, and the water dripping down creates the perfect amount of humidity. And the cave is like a cool environment. It's like the perfect temperature. And it's just like the cheese spa. Like, it's just where cheeses go to, like, you know, come out,
I would like
reborn.
To visit, I would like to visit a cheese spa one day.
Well, it's really cool.
Yeah, you can come to Kaltbach with us. So the Gruyere goes there, and then we have Emmentaler, same thing, because these are like traditional cheeses.
So Emmentaler, I grew up eating as a kid all the time. I loved my ham and Swiss cheese, which is probably why I grew up to love a croque madame. And I never knew the cheese with the holes in it is called Emmentaler.
Emmentaler, yeah. Yeah, it's made in near the Emm River Valley, mm-hmm. Which is in central Switzerland. And it was... The cheese that got the most recognition, if you think like historically, that came was exported to the U.S. And then what happened was people started copying it in the U.S. and other parts of the country. And so that's kind of how its name got diluted a little bit.
Well, it is funny how we have American cheese and Swiss cheese.
Mm-hmm.
But Italy managed to escape Italian cheese and France escaped French cheese.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it's funny how those things take hold.
Yeah.
So, is your fridge filled with cheese?
Most of the time, yes.
Do you eat cheese every day?
No, I don't. people ask me that. I mean, there's something to that, too. Like, I think, like, Europeans eat cheese all the time, but they just have really great cheese. And, you know, my family's like, oh, you're going to get high cholesterol, Alice. And I'm like, well, I'm not eating, like, these, you know, salty, fatty cheeses all the time. I think a lot of these cheeses are part skim, actually, and... No, they're good for you. There's so much protein in them, too. But I don't eat cheese every day. And then it's like every now and then, like, you know, yeah, I just want a little, like, Monterey Jack. I'm sorry, you know? Like, I don't always have to eat great cheese all the time.
Well, also, the other thing about these cheeses, like, when especially, like, the Kaltbach cave-aged one, is I look at it in the way that we look at Parmigiano-Reggiano.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a special cheese. It does cost a little bit more, but you can... It's like... A fondue is even better if you use Emmentaler and Appenzeller and some of the Kaltbach cave age, because it's got all this, it's, you know, it's longer, it's aged, so it's a little saltier, less water content, but it has all this umami.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it's like a little goes a long way. If I wanted to just make like a celery and date salad with some olive oil and lemon juice and a little bit of the Kaltbach cave age, that's like, that's the perfect snack, but you don't need a ton
of it. That
I know, she just came up with this on the spot.
I just said dessert because it sounded so good. Walk us through that salad one more time.
Yeah.
I knew it was a salad. My brain went straight to dessert.
Well, it's funny. I belong to Equinox over in Brooklyn, and I was giving a class to the trainers one time, and I said, because, you know,
you were
training
the trainers?
Yeah, on food stuff, because they all know I'm a chef and everything. And so I was like, let's talk about some interesting things that you can eat, because trainers have schedules like chefs. They're like there all day and night, and they have challenging diets too, because they're just pretty much eating, like, you know, power bars and stuff all the time. So I'm like, you can just chop up some celery. Celery's so good for you. And some dates, all that potassium, you're getting hydrated. And then a little, you know, you need some protein, and the best thing is to have a little bit of that Gruyere cheese with it. It's just like the perfect snack.
And do you dress it with anything?
A little olive oil and lemon
juice.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe some parsley.
Back in the office.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite, like, any time of day kind of things.
Yeah. Snacking is like a big meal part right now. Like, we're doing a lot of research, and like, people snack. Like, and even if you look at like packaged snack foods too, like, people are getting really smart about, like, you know, all of that. But I think with cheese, like, yeah, I eat it in the afternoon. Just as a little, like, in between lunch and dinner time. And
a couple of nuts, a little chunk of cheese.
Totally.
Unlike you, I think we eat cheese every day because of you. Because you've been so generous and gracious with all the cheese that, that our fridge is stocked with it. So there are a lot of female cheesemakers, which makes me really happy.
Yeah. We work, Emmy owns and So Emmy Switzerland is like the mothership, and then I work for the U.S. Branch of it. We're actually Emmy Roth. So there's Emmy that imports cheese from Switzerland that I'm the brand manager for, and then we also make cheeses in Wisconsin, really great Wisconsin cheeses from the Roth brand. But Emmy Switzerland also owns Cowgirl Creamery and Cypress Grove and Redwood Hill, and these are real powerhouse women too, and it's just so wonderful to be in their family too. And and what Emmy has done is just kind of like, they kind of like let them do their thing, and they just kind of help financially. And, you know, like Cypress was able to expand their herds, and, you know, Cowgirl was able to, you know, get business back, you know.
Like, there's so many amazing women in cheese. I also think of Ann Saxelby, who has Saxelby cheese. She's not a cheesemaker per se, she's a cheesemonger. But she's wonderful. You can find her at Essex Market and some other locations.
You know who I love is Kate Arding. Have you ever spoken with her? Oh my gosh, you need to have
her
on the
her.
Show. Kate, she's from England. She used to work at Neil's Yard in England, and she came to California. I met her in the early 90s, and she came to help Peggy and Sue start Cowgirl Creamery. And then she taught them how to make some cheeses, and now she has Talbot and Arding up in Hudson, New York, with her partner Mona Talbot, who's a great chef.
Oh, I know about Mona, sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they have the best little cheese and provision shop up there.
Oh,
and Mona just has all these delicious things, and Kate will tell you everything about all the cheese makers just there. And then she participated in the Oxford cheese, you know, tome that came out, I think, last year or something. But she's got great stories because she knows all these really eccentric cheese makers, and she'll judge cheese making competitions or whatever.
American Cheese Society.
Yeah.
Or something.
So, she can tell you all about, you know, a nun over here in this little town, or the Amish cheeses over here, and how it's just, she's hysterical.
Oh, that's so cool. We'll have to get her on the show.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Well, before we go, a few more things. You've had a super interesting career on the Food Network also. You've done a lot of shows. How did that side of your career emerge?
That all started when, I was, you know, in San Francisco, a restaurant chef, and then sometimes we would get, actually kind of early on, Lifetime came and did some, like a day in a life kind of thing with me one time in my original shop on 14th Street, and some news channels would come in, and I would be really nervous, as one is for, you know, at the beginning of being on camera, or sometimes continues to be, but I just was like, I need to keep working on that skill. I need to be better on camera because I have a lot of things I want to say with food. And so that's kind of really where it started. I also would see some chefs that I was like, well, that they're kind of just playing chef. They're just a television personality. And I get that because we need that. It truly is entertainment. But and then the genre of cooking competition started really happening, and I did some of those early Food Network challenge on the dessert side, but I'd always like make crazy stuff that they just didn't even know what to do with. And so I started developing a personality, I guess, within the Food Network. And then Bravo started Top Chef, and it's funny because I was just cooking with three of the competitors from season 15 on Top Chef in Pebble Beach. And
Tanya, you were with Tanya.
Tanya was out there, but also
Tanya Holland of
Fatima
of
Ali.
Brown Sugar Kitchen in Oakland. And
yeah.
Fatima. Mm-hmm.
Fatima, and then the two other bears. Our lunch was called Goldilocks and the Three Bears, and I was the Goldilocks. And they I have to watch this whole season 15 because I guess they got called the Three Bears. Anyway, it was Bruce Coleman and Tyler Anderson. We were all cooking together. But anyway, so I was like, you guys, we were all talking. I said, I can't believe it's season 15 of Top Chef. I was on the first season of Top Chef on the second ever episode as a judge. And it's funny, we were just shooting this thing for Women Chefs and Restaurateurs of, I did a video version of Food Games, which I've done at WCR every year, which is a live cooking competition, but now I've turned it into a film. Now I get to say a lot more with food, and it's all about sustainability in the future and all that stuff. But I brought Tiffany Faison from the original Top Chef season, the redhead, into my Food Games, and I was telling her, it's just so funny to see all that genre just explode over all these years. And I don't know, I love the cooking competitions, although I think now they're getting a little, I'm a little tired of them. I want to change the game and not have it be so much of a setup for failure or disaster or like, look at this accident, because I feel like media-wise, we're kind of bombarded every day with, like, breaking news and this terrible thing happened over here. And it's like, it's just, I don't want to contribute to that anymore. I still want to play the games. I think chefs are smart people, and we can come up with better solutions for the world rather than just how to use gummy bears in this recipe.
Well, I look forward to seeing what you come up with. We are, Vitor, our engineer, is giving us the wrap it up symbol. I see you, Vitor. So one thing I wanted to say to both of you is you've done a lot for women in food, especially you, Elizabeth, we didn't even get to talk about you being president of Women Chefs and Restaurateurs. You have both been really gracious supporters of Cherry Bomb, and we appreciate that so much. You have no idea.
Thank you.
We love what you're doing from the WCR side. I'm not the president anymore. We have a conference coming up in Minneapolis next month, in a couple weeks. So we're back to back here, Cherry Bomb Jubilee to WCR conference.
Back to back, yeah. Absolutely. But thank you for everything you do. Yes. Thank you, Allison and Emmy, for all the chefs who you support. And, you know,
yes,
thank you, Elizabeth.
We're happy to align with your mission and everything you stand for. So we appreciate it.
Well, that's it for this episode of Radio Cherry Bomb. Sorry, we could keep talking for a long time. Thank you to our engineer, Vitor, who's out there in the control booth, and the band Tra La La for our theme song. And Jubilee this weekend, I can't believe it. It's less than 48. That's really scary. It's less than 48 hours. I'm still standing. I barely have a voice, as you might have noticed if you're a regular listener. But I can't believe Jubilee's happening. Nigella Lawson's going to be there,
so
which
exciting.
Blows my mind. She's going to be signing books. She's doing the big keynote talk. Samin Nosrat, who wrote Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, is interviewing her. I can barely wrap my head around the two of them doing an interview together. And then Ruth Reichel is interviewing Ruth Rogers from the London River Cafe. I mean, it's kind of mind-blowing. So I would love to see you if you are there. Please come up and say hi. You know I love to meet listeners of Radio Cherry Bomb. And like I said, if you're not going to be there, follow all the action at #CBJubilee. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and Heritage Radio Network. Thank you to our sponsors for supporting today's episode, Emmy, the maker of delicious cheeses from Switzerland, and Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
I'll have what she's having.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.